Well, have you ever heard about the Kelly Green Man episode? Well, we're going to talk about that in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Barry, tell us what happened in Kelly, Kentucky.
Well, George, it's again, this is a phenomenal story. It happened a long time ago. 1955, the date was August 21st of that year. And actually, what we try to bring out in the documentary was something that we found out just 1 week prior to this event that I'm about to tell you about. There was an area called Dogtown, Indiana, which is up near Evansville, I believe. And there was a lady named Dora Johnson and one of her friends. They were on a little swimming excursion in the Ohio River. And they spotted a shiny disc-like object in the sky, and it disappeared behind some trees. And just right after this, Mrs. Johnson claimed that fuzzy, claw-like hands grabbed on her leg from under the water. Didn't see anything go into the water. Just felt this feeling of a claw-like hand. It almost tried to drown her, it felt like. And she was struggling in the water. Her friend helped her out of the water. And, of course, 1 week later, on August 21st, it was a hot summer night. A man named Billy Ray Taylor went to the well for a drink of water. There were 11 people at this home. There were 8 adults, 3 children. They were having a little Sunday dinner gathering. And he claimed he saw a light that had all the colors of the rainbow in it, and it came down behind the farm back in this wooded area. Well, he went in and told all these people about it, and they glanced out the windows, didn't see anything, and he just laughed it off like it was a joke. Didn't even bother to go check it out, which I thought was, well, you know, was amazing, because you definitely thought that they would have done that, but they just took it as a joke, didn't believe him. And as night fell, which it was almost dusk at the time he reported the incident, all the dogs started barking, and as they looked out the window, they saw a slight glow coming from the fields. And as they got closer, they saw this little goblin-like creature, not like the gray so much, maybe the same size as the grays as it reported today, but these things had real large pointed ears, and they had long arms with talons, like claws.
Hmm.
And of course,
chupacabra-like?
Sort of chupacabra-like, but sort of glowing yellow eyes. But they were seen to be metallic gray or silvery in color. There was some discrepancy on what they were color-wise. But this little being was approaching the house, and the men freaked out. And what did they do? They went and got the shooting irons. A fellow by the name of Lucky Sutton and Billy Ray, they went out, got the shooting irons, and they leveled shots point-blank range, 12-gauge and a 22, and shot at this thing, and the thing bounced away, and then, you know, another one, or the same one, it came out, they all looked the same, came out from behind the house, they shot again, the thing bounced away. The scariest encounter that night was the fact that they heard these clawing sounds on the roof, like they were on the roof. And a little later on, when they went out to investigate, Billy Ray actually walked out on the porch. And as he got to the edge of the porch where there was a step there, this claw-like hand came down and grabbed him by the hair, almost pulling him up off of his feet. And, of course, Lucky ran out with the shotgun, blasted the thing, saw it on the roof, blasted it off the roof, went flying back over the roof. Later on, they came back, looked in the windows at the people. All of the people saw these creatures. I mean, 11 people saw these creatures, and they shoot right through the windows at these things. And this went on for supposedly several hours. Finally, they got in their vehicles and went into the Hopkinsville, Kentucky police station in shock, reporting the story to the authorities. And when the police got out there, unfortunately, the creatures were gone.
Where'd they go?
Well, nobody knows that for sure, but there was one officer en route to the scene, or I should say at least rumored officer, that was on his way out there, said he saw an object flying into the sky, a meteor-like object flying into the sky. In 1977, I visited that area, and I found an elderly couple living in a nearby farmhouse, and they claimed they remembered hearing the gunshots, and when they looked in the distance, they saw glowing lights that looked like almost like dancing fireflies coming from the fields out there. And I have some actual video of them in the show. But when you mentioned, like, where did they go, well, that's the big question. The police came out, and there was obviously signs of the shooting. The windows were shattered. There was some shotgun shells lying around and this and that. But no sign of the creatures. But the interesting thing was that after the police left, this was about 4 in the morning, the family returned to the house quite shaken. Glennie and Lucky were in the living room. I believe Glennie was on a couch and Lucky was on a chair there. And this creature again showed up in the window. It returned one more time. Lucky shot through the window. Creature disappeared, never saw it again. But now, what was interesting about this, I interviewed a fellow by the name of Russell Ferguson, a very nice gentleman. He was a sheriff deputy who actually was out there at the location that night, and he was pretty skeptical, as most law enforcement people are.
Right.
They didn't
until they see something themselves.
That's right. He had talked about that the odd thing to him was that one of the gunshots through this screen window was had a square bullet hole pattern. And he says, well, you know, I've never seen the weapon or that could have made a shot like that. And, you know, implying, I suppose, that a gun can't make a square bullet hole pattern. Now, this is interesting. But at the time, he didn't realize that I had located, actually, I had located it after the interview. I found a lady and her brother named Norman Wendell McCord that were related to the Langfords that lived in the home. Glennie was Lucky's mother. Glennie Langford, and they had a photograph of the window screen and with the bullet holes, and this one bullet hole pattern did look, you know, very rectangular. So I took it to a fellow by the name of Joe Ferrero. He's out here. He owns a company called Gun World out here in Burbank, California, and he's a ballistics expert. He was in Vietnam. He's a Vietnam War vet. He can tell you everything you want to know about gunshots and bullet patterns. And he looked at it and he did his own tests, and he said that he showed us that you can make a square bullet pattern, depending on how far you are away from the screen when the shots were fired. But the fact that you get a square bullet pattern, it comes from the fact that in the screen itself is made up of rectangular squares, little weaves in the screen. So, you know, depending on where the gun was placed, it wasn't that far away. It can produce a square bullet hole. So, because, you know, the theory was that these people had taken a tobacco stick, like a stake, and poked it through the windows, the screens, and had created a hoax. But this proved that was not a hoax, that these people were firing at something. Something frightened them enough.
Did they hit it? These objects? I mean, did they make a ping sound or what? Because they obviously didn't seem hurt.
Yes, they did. They actually described a metallic sound, and Lucky said that it sounded like hitting the bottom of a bucket, you know, like something metal hitting the bottom of a bucket.
Like these things could have been robotic?
Yes. Sort of like that, but I guess it's possible. But they didn't make a sound. But they looked alive. That was the thing. They looked alive, but they did make a metallic sound. But these creatures were never seen again after that incident. And it was interesting. But if you look back on, you know, what was going on ufologically at the time, there was a lot of UFO sightings going on all around the tri-state area, Indiana, Kentucky, and Ohio at that time, and on that same evening. And so the thing that really impressed me, George, about this story, and you would know, being a journalist yourself, is I can't imagine 11 people, 11 frightened individuals, you know, fleeing their home in the middle of the night, going to the police station, telling this wild story, and their descriptions of the creatures all matched pretty darn close. Now, what I'd like to tell you about that incident that is fascinating is that even though they described him as rather silvery or metallic gray, there's still not a clear definition of that in appearance. Some reporter from the Evansville News or Evansville Times, I believe, he took journalistic license and called them, quote, little green men of Kelly, you know, when it came out in the news.
Right.
And that's where the term little green men comes from. came from that incident, as far as what I was told.
These things look a little like gremlins, don't they?
They do. They do look like gremlins. Or the vernacular there was goblins, you know, that they've been referred to as the goblins of Kelly or the Kelly goblins.
What was the follow-up after it happened in that area? Did they get any kind of media coverage, anything specific in newspapers?
Well, you know, there was a lot of newspaper reports. In fact, the New Era paper the following day had it right on the front page headlines about spaceship and 12 little men reported in Kelly, investigation ongoing or something like that today. There was a lot of people that came out there and tromped around the property, driving the people crazy. You know, they were taking pictures. And believe it or not, the people actually wound up leaving their home, I believe, within days or a week later. It wasn't that long. And some relatives moved into the house. And the people were shaken. I can't imagine these people would leave their home because of something like that. And the other thing, according to Police Chief Russell Greenwell, who investigated it, he says, okay, maybe the other people were questionable, but he said that Glennie Langford, who was the matriarch of that family, the grandmother, she was the pillar of the community. She was a very, very honest person. And they said, and everyone who knew her said, if she said she saw those creatures, then they were there.
They were there. Something was there.
Something was there, George. And fright factor, they were terrified.
What about footprints?
Found no footprints. Found no footprints. But sometimes the creatures, they were said to have walked, but sometimes they were also said to have floated. There's some controversy on that. So, of course, there had been no rain at that time. The ground was pretty dry, and there was a lot of grass, so you know, it's possible they didn't leave footprints. However, there was an incident where one was in a tree. It was sitting up on top of a tree branch. The men shot it. It kind of bounced off this branch. They saw it land in an adjacent field behind the tree. Now, as they moved towards that area, the creature seemed to scurry off very rapidly, by the way. These things move very, very quickly.
Sure do, yeah.
And there was a luminous glow on the ground. Now, it wasn't there when the police got there, although there was a rumor that one of the policemen, when he first got there, thought they saw something like that. But it was never proved that, you know, never confirmed that he saw something.
So how do we know these folks weren't into the old moonshine?
Well, that's a good question. They even the police who did the investigation said there was no drinking at night. And Mrs. Langford was pretty adamant about not having the family drinking around the children on a Sunday night like that. Not to say that these people, you know, so many people may not have drank at other times. But that particular night, the police reports that they could find no evidence of alcohol whatsoever on the premises.
Let's move on to some other cases. Flatwoods. We've talked to Frank.
Frank Pacina.
Pacina. And incredible story there.
Oh, yeah. Frank did a great book, the Braxton County Monster, cover-up of the Flatwoods Monster story. And it was a very good book. I met Frank in Flatwoods. We went back there in 2002, actually, for the 50th anniversary of that event. And we met up with Stanton Friedman there,
yes,
who was there. And
Great guy. Isn't Stan a great guy?
Oh, he's fantastic. And such enthusiasm for the phenomena after,
yes,
all these years. And we actually made a little pilgrimage up the same pathway that those children and Mrs. May and the National Guardsmen took, up that hill, and where this UFO has reportedly landed. Now, what makes the story interesting? I found it very fascinating. Again, you have an incident that was collectively witnessed by a group of people, and not only a group of people that supposedly saw a creature, but this whole thing started with, you know, there was just amazing amount of UFO sightings that night, all up and down the eastern seaboard of the country as well. And what happened was I had talked with a fellow by the name of Neil Nunley. Neil was about 14 at the time, and he gave us the only interview he said he's ever given on camera. And he lives near Kent State, Ohio. And he told us that they were playing football, he and a group of boys, and that this object came around the mountain and made a right-angle turn. Now, the official explanation was, I guess, by the Air Force, was that this was probably a meteor, but I don't know of any meteor that makes a right-angle turn.
No, Either do I. Plus, a lot of people describe this as being robotic-looking, didn't they?
Yes, they did. I wanted to address that, George, because what happened was this thing landed on top of this hill. Of course, they go up there. Two of the boys and their mother live at the base of this hill. And this is up in the Appalachians, and it's a very remote area. And as this group of people went up the hill, they first noticed a very pungent odor in the air, and there was a fog that was settling all over the ground area. And as they went up this hill, they saw these two glowing eyes staring down at them from this tree. As they were looking at this fireball or whatever it was, this huge object as big as a house, changing colors, it was predominantly a very bright cherry red in color. And as they looked off to the left, there's this huge creature reported. You probably have seen the sketches of it, the original sketches.
Yes, I sure have.
It's a very weird image. It's a creature it looked like, according to the sketches.
It looked like Master Cylinder from the old comic days. Do you remember that?
Yes, I do. Sort of like that. And had a perfectly round, blood-red face, glowing eyes, and I don't know if there were claws or not. The original sketch was depicted as having claws. But they saw this thing and just started floating towards them. And, of course, this happened in an instant. Now, when I spoke with Neil about that, Neil was very honest about it. He said, I went up the hill. He says, I saw that UFO, and that UFO went over at treetop level. This thing was low as it went over. And it actually, when it got to this crest of the hill, it stopped above some trees before it settled down onto the crest of that hill. And Stanton Friedman, by the way, he mentioned that is the highest point of ground in that whole area there. So it makes sense if this was a UFO or some kind of spaceship or something, and if it had some kind of problem, that made sense. That's where it would have landed to whatever, initiate repairs or whatever it had to do. But you mentioned a few moments ago, George, about the robotical thing. Well, Neil said that he was probably the only one that didn't get the greatest look at it. He says he wanted us to realize that this thing happened very fast. He got a great look at the UFO. He said he had kind of wandered ahead of the group just a little ways, and he was just fixated on this object. This object was huge, on this hilltop. And suddenly he heard this fellow by the name of Gene Lemon. Gene was actually a young guy at the time, 17. He had just joined the West Virginia National Guard. And he heard him say something, oh, my God, it's going to get us or something. And he looked very quickly. Well, they started running. They immediately started running, and Neil got caught up in this pandemonium. And as he's running with the group, he says he does look and see this thing. And he described it as a huge shadow, huge, coming, floating towards them. And he said it looked so menacing, the way it looked, just that shadow. But he didn't get a really good look at the details of it. I know that there's been some speculation, as you mentioned, about it being a robot. I asked two of the eyewitnesses when I was there at the reunion that they had of the Flatwoods 50th anniversary. I believe it was Tommy Heyer. I asked one of the May boys. I believe it was Fred May. I'm not positive on that. No, I'm sorry, Eddie May. Eddie May, I think it was, and Fred's brother. And he said that. The object of them didn't look that robotical. They thought it looked, I said, what did it look like? They thought it looked closer to that original sketch, unlike some of the robotical drawings.
Right.
So I'm on the fence on that, whether or not to think whether that's some kind of a probe or.
That's a good analogy, some kind of a probe. It acted like it.
Yes. But it was big. We know it was big. We know there was a UFO there. Ivan Sanderson went to that location. He was a famous naturalist and a cryptozoologist at the time. He went there with a group of people to investigate it just a few days after this thing happened. And I believe, according to his report, they found a flattened area at the top of that hill up there. And, again, people were trying to debunk this, saying, oh, this is an owl, But I don't know why they don't give these country people more credit. These people have grown up with nature.
Absolutely. Hey, stay with us. More stories, Barry, coming up, okay? And, by the way, those of you trying to figure out who in the heck was Master Cylinder, he was with the old cartoon character Tom Terrific, if you remember that. Some of you will. Well, circle the calendar. Halloween Tuesday at 1 p.m., I'll be in Skokie, Illinois for our book signing of Worker in the Light at the Barnes & Noble Old Orchard Center, Skokie, Illinois. Come on by and say hello. The book, of course, is available at Borders, Barnes & Noble, Target, Walmart, other stores, and also on Amazon.com. But a lot of you have expressed interest in the audio version of the book. Some of you visually impaired, others just like to listen to these at home or in your car. The audio version, I know for a fact, is available on Amazon.com. So if you just go there, you put in books, type in Worker in the Light, and the book version will come up. But somewhere in that, you'll see audio version. You can click that. There's a discount on that as well. Master Cylinder was in the Felix the Cat cartoons. Tom Terrific was his own little strange character, but Master Cylinder was in the Felix the Cat cartoons. Remember when Poindexter was in that and all that? Man, that's going way, way back. I bet some of you don't even remember that. Barry, do you remember that?
I remember the Tom Terrific character. Wasn't that the little guy who had the funnel cap?
Yeah, that, and he could turn himself. He shapeshifted into anything he wanted.
He did, and he had his mighty dog, Manfred.
Manfred. And, you know, what was funny about Tom Terrific was that if he turned himself into a, let's say, a chair, somewhere on that chair was his little face in that little helmet. Remember? His head was always there.
Yes. You know, I wonder if those were out in DVD. I'd love to get some of those.
Yeah, but Master Cylinder was with Felix the Cat, and he was something else.
Absolutely.
Let's talk a little bit about what you do for documentaries, and then we'll talk about a few more cases. The next hour, when we open up the phone lines, you know, I'd like people to ask you questions, but also to relate some of their stories to you. And we've got to talk about Haunted Los Angeles before we're done with this program tonight as well. How do you determine what stories to pick in order to make documentaries?
Well, that's a good question, George. I've always had this weird penchant for the weird. I look at a story for its strange factor, but not just its strange factor. I look at it for, you know, a credibility factor as well. You know, it's one thing if some, just one person, a single person reports a story and the whole thing is based on that, because that could be anything, anybody's guess. But I look for stories that are just unusual, strange, but yet I'm looking for that element of fear, the collectivity factor, where there's more than one witness, obviously. The Kelly story in the flat was, all of the stories, like Mothman.
They're all great stories.
All great stories, all collectively witnessed. And, you know, getting back to the Mothman just briefly, I over 100 people saw that creature. Even one of the deputy sheriffs, a fellow by the name of Alvy Sullivan, saw it, was chased by it. It's a story you don't always hear about, but he was chased by it. He was so unnerved that he left and went across the river to Gallup Police, wanted to join that police force because he didn't want to patrol the TNT area.
Can you rule out, though, with Mothman, a large bird? You know, we talk about the Thunderbird, this huge bird that a lot of people seem to see. You know, Native American mythology talked about this huge bird.
Yes.
Can we rule that out as being, you can, okay.
I can, George, because in the one thing, how I would rule that out, for one thing, is the fact that everybody who saw this thing always described, they saw the muscular legs, it looked human. The body part, the torso, the legs, everything looked human. And I can't imagine any kind of a real bird looking anything remotely human.
Well, that's true.
You know, I just don't. I don't know if any bird can fly over 100 miles an hour. Maybe there are. I'm not an aviary person. But I really believe it was something of high strangeness that appeared there in 1966, 67. And look at all of the UFO sightings. Almost every time that this creature appeared, there were UFO sightings. Marcella Bennett, who was one of the key witnesses, she's with her brother Raymond Walmsley, and they were going to visit a friend, and she was coming out of the house towards her car, and this creature was standing next to the car. She got a really good look at it, and it had this paralyzing effect. I mean, standing there with glowing red eyes, and she fell on top of her child, and they hit the ground, and her brother was watching this UFO. When she came out of it, the creature had left, and then they ran into the house, and they were followed. The thing came up onto the porch. The glowing red eyes were seen staring through the window at them. And so that's not a bird, nothing that would follow you like that and walk bipedally like that, and as well as fly, and have, you know, the human appearance. You know, as far as from the chest down into the legs, it was all described. Very muscular legs and glowing red eyes. What bird would be that glowing and that mesmerizing? You know, it doesn't make sense. It's got to be something interdimensional or it's obviously something in the paranormal realm for sure.
What is, in your entire career, the scariest story you've ever heard?
Well, George, I'm going to tell you a story now that changed my life forever. It's a scenario that no scriptwriter could duplicate because this one was for real. And this happened in San Pedro, California, right south of L.A. here in 1989. I was with Dr. Taff at the time. We got a call from a lady named Susan Castaneda. She was calling on behalf of her friend Jackie Hernandez. Jackie had just moved into a small little bungalow down there off of 11th Street. And there was there were strange things going on. She claimed that objects moved off shelves. A strange viscous liquid appeared on the walls. But the scariest thing, the two scariest things that occurred there, was she saw this desiccated-looking old man wearing high-water pants, a red flannel shirt, sitting cross-legged on the bunk bed in her children's bedroom. He would appear and stare at her for several minutes before disappearing. It was unusual. And then the other thing that happened was that one day she decided to check out her attic. Someone had found money in their attic, and she says, why don't you look up in your attic? Maybe there's something up there worth something. So she stood on top of this washing machine, put a milk crate up there, and looked in, and she said she saw a disembodied head floating towards her.
Oh, gosh.
Oh, yeah. Well, George, this all sounds like the stuff that motion pictures are made out of.
You got it.
You know, so we went down there. I mean, you know, I got to let people know, we are skeptical on every case until paranormal phenomena presents itself. I mean, and we thoroughly check out everything that happens before we would determine a paranormal, you know, cause for that phenomena. But I was working with a fellow, but at the time he worked with me. His name was Jeff Wheatcraft. Very nice man. He actually was a still photographer at one point in New York, a fashion photographer. And before that, he was a school principal in Nebraska, and he quit that job because he wanted to get into a more glamorous profession, I guess you might say. But he eventually wound up here in Hollywood, and we'd worked on a movie together years ago over at Disney Studios, and we struck up a friendship. Well, anyway, Jeff was the supreme skeptic. He was there with me on this one night, August 8th, 1989, we went in and interviewed the woman, and she told us all these stories about the apparitions and, you know, the psychokinetic movement of objects and all these things that were going on. And when she told us the story about the attic, I thought that was intriguing. But when we walked in the house, I remember it was a very hot, sultry night, you know, very, very hot. And I really didn't want to hang out there too long because it was just because the heat was so bad. There was no air conditioning in the house. But before we left, and that was probably around 10 o'clock, I asked if we could go through the house. And so we did. We took a little tour of the house. And as we went back to the back of the house, I noticed sort of an overpressure in my head. You know that feeling you get when you're several fathoms below water?
Yep.
Get that little overpressure, sort of a, that's sort of what I felt. But I didn't attribute that to anything paranormal at the time. I asked Jeff Wheatcraft to, if he would mind, to take a few pictures up in the attic. Well, he didn't go all the way up into the attic. There was this little laundry room. And so we put the milk crate up there on top of that, and he was a tall guy, so he stood up on top of that, and we took the little trap door off, and he peered in there, and he took a few pictures. Well, he came down, and I said, "You see anything?" He says, "No." And I said, "Well, you look funny." I said, "There's, you know," he had kind of a quizzical look on his face. And he says, "You know, I didn't see anything, but," he says, "I felt like something was watching me, and it was like behind me." So another one of the gentlemen there, Larry Brooks, says, "Why don't you go up and take some pictures over your shoulder?" So he went up and, you know, kind of humorously laughed at that, but he went up anyway and was taking some pictures. He was in his third frame. He had a 35 millimeter Canon, one of those bayonet mount lenses. And as he's clicking off, squeezing off the third frame, George, suddenly the camera was jerked out of his hands. Jerked. I mean, just flew out of his hands. And he comes, you know, back down. He's shaking. You know, all the colors drained out of him. And we said, what happened? What happened? And he said, something just pulled the camera out of my hands. And I said, you're serious? And he said, yes. So, I had video equipment. I hadn't even brought it in. I had that, remember the three-quarter-inch video?
Yeah, yeah.
It had a deck, you know, and the camera. I brought it. I reached out and got the equipment. I said, let's go back up there and let's see what happened. So we went back up, and I had the camera rolling as I went into this attic. And it wasn't a very big attic. This was a very small house. But it was dark enough. I mean, it was big enough you could stand up in there, though. But as I say, I was rolling the camera as I went into the attic. And suddenly, only about a minute later, my camera was suddenly neutralized by something. You know, the power just kicked out of it. No explanation for that. But here's the interesting thing. The camera and the deck were powered separately by separate batteries. They both were out. But it wasn't the batteries. It was something else that was shutting us down, you know, molecularly, internally in the camera. Well, shortly after that, I mean, I was amazed by that. But shortly after that, Jeff found the body of his camera lying in this little box on the other side of the attic. And he found the lens port side up lying behind the trapdoor. He put the lens back on the camera. Camera was not damaged. Started clicking on pictures. Shortly after that, this pungent odor, it smelled like decaying flesh, started permeating the attic. At that point, I said, you know, I think I'm going to get out of here. And I started to go down to this opening. Jeff was above me, and I'm handing off the camera to the fellow down below. And I see Jeff's face contort in this horrifying contortion, you know, of fear. I didn't know what had happened. He couldn't talk. And as he came down, I said, what happened? He said he felt a large, bony hand pressing into his back. And, of course, he had massive internal bruising in his back, as we found out later. But as soon as we came down out of that attic, George, the camera equipment came back on. I started filming. We heard footsteps raking across the attic. Later on, Jeff just poked his head back up quickly and saw this large black mass moving back and forth. But this story gets even stranger and scarier. On the evening of September 4th, we get a call from Jackie Hernandez. All of it was recorded on tape. We started recording the phone calls at this point, trying to document this whole situation, you know. And we go down there. It's Jeff, Gary Bame. Gary Bame is an old friend of mine from Ohio. He was totally skeptical as well. Jeff was becoming a believer, I think, at that point, but wasn't sure yet. He wasn't sure what had happened the first night. We go down to this lady's house at about 1 o'clock in the morning. She called, and she was in a panic because she said some invisible force had held her down on the floor, and she couldn't move. You know, it's just an invisible force. She was suffocating her. She couldn't breathe either for a few minutes. And she said if it wasn't for the will of her children, she had a small baby and a young boy, 3. She said she doesn't know if she could have broken out of that. She suddenly just, her will, I guess, broke her out of that. She was able to get up and run outside and get some air. Well, anyway, she said things were happening. She said the door was opening and closing, slamming back and forth. Objects were being hurled at it. The children's toys were being levitated off the ground. We go down there, George. I'll never forget this night as long as I live. We go down there. Very quiet. No cold spots. You know, you hear about cold spots.
Yes.
And so, well, that did happen later on in this case, but not that night. No cold spots, no odors, nothing. Jeff and Gary decide they're going to go up in the attic. And they go up in the attic. I said, I think I'm going to stay down below tonight. You know, 'cause I was still
don't blame you.
Nervous, George, about that first night.
Sure.
Up there. So they go up, and they're up there. You know, and Jeff is really trying to explain to Gary, look, here's where my camera was grabbed. Here's where I was pushed. He was telling him all these things. Again, very quiet. They're up there for about 20 minutes. I'm below this attic crawl space in this little laundry room. Jackie Hernandez, the lady who was the victim of this haunting, she was soon joined by one of her neighbors, Susan, again, came over. And I was just talking with them down below, not really thinking anything was going to happen because it was so quiet. And suddenly a little orb of light shot in front of me, a tear-shaped reddish color to it, and it went through a wall. But it was very quick, so I didn't really get a good look at it. And the two ladies saw it as well. And I got kind of alert. I had my camera there, and I got kind of alert. I still hadn't turned the camera on yet because, you know, I wasn't sure what was going on. Right. And then shortly after that, George, just it wasn't long. I've never had this feeling before or since or even later on during this investigation, but I had this feeling out of my peripheral vision of being watched. There was a bathroom there right to my left, and I felt something watching me. But when I'd look, turn and look, nothing. I didn't see anything visually. And then shortly after that, just within, you know, a few seconds after I had that feeling, we all three heard this snapping sound. It was just like three snaps of someone snapping their fingers three times. And I don't know, it was just like it's right there, no visible source for the sound. And suddenly I just get really alert. I turned the camera, hit the button on the camera, and suddenly we all hear this groan. Now, I had yelled up to the guys upstairs, said, come down, come down. You know, I feel like there's something going on down here. I was getting very, very nervous. And what happened was Gary was over the opening, and Jeff had just taken one step. He was back in the center part of the attic, and Gary used his flash camera and took a couple flash pictures as he went along, not to get pictures so much, but to see where Jeff was, because Jeff's flashlight hit the floor and it went out. And when he got over to the middle of the attic, George, he found Jeff hanging with an old weathered clothesline cord wrapped about 15, it was twisted about 15 times around his neck.
Oh my God.
So something unseen came out of the darkness of this attic and tried to strangle him to death.
Was he okay?
He was okay, but when Gary had to bend the nail that was protruding from this rafter beam, he had to bend it down to release Jeff, because Jeff's neck was really tight, and Jeff had bad burns in his neck from that, you know, rope burns from that. Jeff said that when he came to, by the way, he said when he took one step, he took that first step, he said something hit him in the neck, and he blacked out, like there was missing time. We were amazed just how quickly that this happened, and by the way, when he was coming to, there was a sensation that something was pulling on his legs, like it was really trying to kill him up there. So he comes scrambling out of the attic. So if you see my documentary, An Unknown Encounter, or we've also had that in California and Lafonda, you'll see the actual footage of him scrambling out of that attic with that rope. And I got an on-the-spot, you know, interview. I mean, he was really shaken. And you can see those rope burns in his neck. And then shortly after that, I didn't see these things with my naked eye. But when we got back and looked at the footage later on, these little orbs of light are shooting all over the rooms. One buzzes atop of his head as he's standing in the living room holding that cord, you know, that tried to strangle Jeff.
Barry, your websites are linked at coasttocoastam.com. The video, Monsters of the UFO, are they available to people?
The first episode is the incident at Kelly. The Mothman and the Flatwoods are still in post-production. We were behind schedule, George, due to Lisa's illness over the last 2 years. So we had intended to finish these up several years ago, but because of her illness, we had to put everything on hiatus. But the Incident at Kelly episode 1 is available,
okay.
And as well as an unknown encounter in California's most haunted.
When we come back, let's talk about some of the haunted Los Angeles spots. And also, we'll open up the phone lines. If you have a question for Barry Conrad, fire away. Perhaps you have your own strange story that you'd like to share with us as well. I'm George Norrie. We'll be back with you in just a moment on Coast to Coast AM. If you need to email me, well, that's always simple as well. That's George at coasttocoastam.com. Once again, congratulations to the St. Louis Cardinals defeating the New York Mets. They are now the National League pennant champs. They will play my Detroit Tigers in the World Series. The game starts on Saturday. My, oh, my, oh, my. Who shall I root for?